Oh, Rashi's in there packing a bag. It looks like he's going somewhere. Hey, Rashi, have you given up on summer jobs?
Nah, I'm out of here for the whole summer. So long, suckers.
Where are you going? Summer camp?
Yes, I am going up to the secret cove in the grove where the camaraderie blows about the way the wind shakes the leaves on the trees.
Wait a minute.
Hey, do you know where... What?
Sounds like you're going to the Bohemian Grove.
Well, do you know where my... I'm not going to tell you where I'm going. It's a secret. Where is my shirt with the owl on it?
Ratchet, you can't get into the Bohemian Grove.
Get into the Bohemian Grove.
I know I can't. It's for captains of industry and world leaders and artists and musicians.
Precisely.
And what makes you think you'll be welcome up there?
Because they sent me a hand-engraved invitation with the blood of George W. Bush.
Wow.
Yeah.
Man, that's impressive.
Listen, you better recognize.
Can I visit?
No.
Okay.
Private.
You know, don't forget Comic-Con. We're going to go again this year. Remember?
Oh, yes, Comic-Con. Where all the plebes blow around because they haven't taken a shower, and you hope the wind does not blow so you don't have to smell them, and everyone walks around in ill-used shower curtains and Captain America t-shirts, even though none of them could run across two sidewalks.
You know, our listenership is plummeting by the second.
Yeah, well, our listenership was pretty low to begin with. I think we're going to be okay.
Hi, this is Paul Dini.
This is Rashi Dini.
Yeah, this is Rashi Dini, and it looks like I'm going to be spending the summer at home because in the space of about 2 minutes, we've managed to insult any place I might have gone this summer.
Yeah, well, at least we are an equal opportunity rooter.
Yeah, we're pretty much rude for everybody.
Well, let's see, we're not prejudiced. We just hate all people.
Speak for yourself.
Well, I do.
Yeah, I know. Misty's
I gotta go finish packing.
Okay.
All right.
Misty's not here tonight, so Grandpa Agnes and Hobart have patched up their feud, and they're out hitting the bars, and Super Rica has taken on 3 more summer jobs, so it's me, Ezra, Emily, the pups, and the phone, because hey. I think we're going to do another questions night.
Oh, fantastic.
That sounds good.
Yeah.
So, Ezra, if you wouldn't mind cueing the questions music.
Questions from the fans.
Okay, we got Ezra on the questions. I've got my cell phone, and we should be able to handle every question that you could conceivably have for me here. Misty's not here tonight. She's off preparing for a film shoot tomorrow. She's doing a very interesting project. I don't really want to say what it is. I'll let her talk about it on the next podcast, but it is amazing, and I've been seeing her rehearse it all week, and it's really going to be eye-opening. So that's all I'll say about that. But anyway, on to our questions. Ezra, who do we have up?
Well, the first one is a popular guy, Harry Knowles.
My old pal, Harry Knowles.
Yeah. Paul Dini, tell us about the Halloween costumes of your life.
Halloween costumes of my life. Gosh, there have been so many. Oh, Harry Knowles, by the way, in case you don't know or have been living under a rock, is the grand webmaster, creator, king of all things over at Ain't It Cool News, one of the best movie sites out there, and a celebrity in his own right, and a damn righteous cowpoke who I've known for many a year now, and also the president of Texas. Not many people know that, but he is.
Wow.
Texas seceded from the Union secretly several years ago, and Harry is now president, King Deluxe of Texas. That's his actual title. Anyway, Halloween costumes of my life. Oh, there have been so many. The great costumes. The first one I ever remember having, I think, was a Wolfman costume when I was maybe in first grade. That was the first thing I wanted to dress up as, and that was like the Ben Cooper Get It Out of the Box costume. I was terrible with costumes, and I still am. I could never buy just one each Halloween. And
it always comes down to the line for you, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I'm such a... I'm so conflicted about the whole thing, is that I would go out and I would go to the local toy store, and all the costumes back there, now I think they still sell costumes with plastic masks, but they're on hangers at like the Walmart or a Target or something. They used to come in boxes with these great cellophane covers, and you could see all your TV favorites. You'd know if a character was really going to be around for a while if they got a Halloween costume made of them. So when I was a kid, it was things like, I mean, it would go back to like classic cartoon characters. It'd be like Donald Duck and Woody Woodpecker, and then there'd be things right up to things like G.I. Joe and You know, every year there'd be a new popular show and then the costumes to come along, you know, based on that. So I used to love going down and picking out my one costume. And then I would wear it out like the month before Halloween and rip the shit out of it. And so I'd wind up, you know, cutting holes in the sheet like Charlie Brown and being a ghost or something lame. Or the old usual, you know, like rub some dirt on my eyes. I'm a hobo. Give me my Baby Ruth bar, stuff like that. But I think that Wolfman costume was the first one I had. I would convince my mom that I wanted the costume, and I would buy like a really goofy costume, like Huckleberry Hound or Yogi Bear or something. And then I would get it home and I'd go like, I can't dress up like Yogi Bear. The other kids are going to rag on me. So I would keep the costume. And then I would, again, I'd be a hobo or something, or just go as myself. And my mom would say, what happened to the Yogi Bear costume? And it's like, I'm not going to wear that. It's stupid looking. I'm not going to wear it out with my friends, but it was cool. I liked having it. Years later, I would, then I kind of got out of Halloween for a long time. And then I began getting back into it in my 20s and 30s, because Halloween now is on a par with Christmas, where you put a lot of effort into the costumes and everything. And so people really get, you know, put a lot of effort into it. And the masks are so cool, and the makeup. And living in Hollywood, you can go to like a professional makeup guy and he can make you into a zombie or a werewolf or a mummy or a vampire or something. And people spend a bundle on it. Here's a funny story. Years ago when I was at Warner Brothers Animation, I don't know how it happened, but somehow we were working on Batman. I guess it was Batman. Maybe it was like right around the year that Batman came out. It was like 92, 93. It was every year Aladdin came out. Somehow it got around on the crew that I worked with that everybody would really love it if I came dressed as Princess Jasmine to the Halloween party. They were going to throw a big Halloween party. And I said, aha, Princess Jasmine. Yeah, that's really funny. That's something you'll never see. And then it got around and suddenly people began demanding it. Suddenly I'm looking at these horrific caricatures of myself in the Jasmine costume. You know, like people are, we want to see this. They took up a collection. They bought me the Princess Jasmine costume in the biggest size they could get. And they said, please wear it. Just wear it. You know, you look so cute in the poofy pants and the top and the wig and everything. And I'm saying, I'll look like ass in this. I'm not going to wear this. And they said, why not? It's funny. And I said, that's the point. If I looked good in it, I would wear it. I think it would be cute, but I'm not going to, I know how horrific I'm going to look in this thing. I'm going to be bulging out of everything. I can't wear this stuff, you know, and I cannot wear, you know, I'm not going to look good in this. And everybody said, we don't want you to look good. We want you to look ridiculous. And my attitude was, well, if I'm not going to look pretty, I'm not going to wear it. And everybody was really pissed off at me. And finally, it got to the point where I said, okay, all right. I make you a solemn promise. At the big Halloween party, I will show up dressed in drag. And I promise you, on my solemn swear, you will see me dressed as a woman that night. But I'm going, you know, but if it's not, but just, you know, maybe Jasmine, I have to see how I feel about that. But I will come in full drag, I promise you that. And I did. I let my beard grow for about 3 days, and then I came as a nun.
Nice.
And I looked very good. I looked the part very well. And I came in, and I was very holy, and yeah. I was actually a very cute nun. And people were still pissed. It's like, we wanted the Jasmine costume. Aww. I said, I'm coming as a girl. I'm a nun. Okay? That's as close as I can come comfortably to doing this.
Yeah, you get nuns on the run. That's what you get.
Yeah, that's right. And that's as far as I'd go for that. One year, Bruce Timm was really saying, you know, the two of us as a Supergirl would be really, we'd really creep everybody out. It's like, you do it. That year I came as the Loch Ness Monster. He came as Supergirl. And he looked great.
Nice.
He looked real cute as Supergirl. But that's the thing. It's like, I cannot pull it off. I cannot pull off the girly look.
Blonde hair that helps him. It's
you know, we have so many costumes. And Misty has row after row of costumes and dance outfits and showgirl costumes. And I've tried it just for mm-hmm. the sake of laugh. You know, Okay, let me put on the showgirl costumes. You know, you know, like going to a party, it's like, I can't even get in those damn things. I have shoulders that are about the size of a city block.
Exactly.
They're kind of slumpy and rounded, but the few times I've actually given it the old college try, like I really thought it would be fun to put on the dress and go to a party or something, it cannot be done.
You'd have to go to one of those weird specialty big and tall women's stores or something.
I have to go to a store where guys, you know, buy that stuff, you know,
specifically to dress up, like a drag store or something.
Yeah. You know, and that amount of stuff, it just ain't for me. The last time I was going to do it, and I thought this would be something I could pull off wonderfully, is I was going to go with a bunch of guys. We're going to go as a Scooby-Doo gang, and I was going to go as Velma.
Nice.
And I said, look, all I need are orange socks, pair of loafers, a little brown skirt, which I can get anywhere, and a big bulky orange sweater. And I don't even have to wear a wig. I'll just comb my hair differently. And I got the glasses already.
Yeah.
And our face structure is kind of similar. We could pass as relatives. So I thought, and I go, where am I going to get a big bulky turtleneck sweater like that? I couldn't find one.
Wow.
I looked everywhere. And this was right before Scooby-Doo had this resurgence. And now I think you can get the costume anyway. You can actually get a Velma costume. But this was like 95 or 96 or something. And I actually went to Macy's. And I was a lot lighter then than I am now. I was at least, you know, 80 pounds lighter. So I should have been able to find something. But I said, okay, I want a big bulky orange sweater. We don't have them. It was like, well, this is what I want, this orange sweater. We don't make that. You know, it had to get it with a pattern or something. It's just like, it was impossible to find. So I just gave it up. And actually, I stayed home that year. No, I think I went to a party, but I just didn't dress up. Mm. But those are, so those were some of the abortive costumes. I will say that for a long time, I was going to a great Halloween party here in town. My friend Shane Black, the writer and director, would have this great Halloween party, legendary Halloween party at his house. And it was a big show business thing, and people would work for months on their costume, and you'd go and you'd see the most amazing costumes, incredible makeup and clothing and prosthetics and everything. One year I really went out and I went as Merlin. I actually did my face up and I got a prosthetic nose and a beard and I did the whole makeup thing and I got this big wizardly costume and I looked more like Yen Sid, the wizard from Fantasia that beats Mickey with the broom at the end. And that was actually my model for it, was Yen Sid. And his parties were legendary. And I remember Seth Green would go to those, and I've known Seth for years. I love Seth. He's a great guy. And when we were working on Batman Beyond, he was one of the regular characters on that. Mm-hmm. And I would run into him at Shane's party, and you know, we'd say hi, how you doing? And then I remember one year after, it was right after the party. We were in the recording booth together and he goes, hey, you going to go to Shane's party next year? And I go, yeah, if he invites me, yeah, sure, I'll go. He goes, well, I'm working on my costume already. And throughout the whole year, Seth was every time he'd come in for recording, Paul, you got your costume yet? It's like, well, Seth, it's kind of hard to think about Halloween as it's February. Oh, I've got mine already done. And it's really great. It's really great. And all year he would talk about, oh, I've got this great costume. And finally it gets down to Halloween, and all I can think about is, like, I want to see Seth's great costume. Where's his great costume? So I come into the party, and I'm looking around, and I ask everybody who knows, who would know him, like, Seth Green here yet? No, I haven't seen him. And I'm looking around, and I don't see him anywhere, and I go, either his costume is really, really good, or he's just not here.
Uh-huh.
And the only person I could see who would know where he was, Sarah Michelle Gellar was there with some of her friends, and I don't know her, but I figured it's a party. Everybody kind of, you know, knows everybody. So I went up to her and I said, hi, I'm friends with Seth Green. Is he here? And she said, no, he's working tonight. He's got a job up in Canada. He didn't come.
Ah, all that time, all year long.
Although I heard later that he did come, that he made it back and came to the party really late. I still don't know what his costume was.
You never found out? He never told you?
No. I have to ask him, you know, because I still work with him. And at some point I'll say, what was your costume? What did you come as? Or maybe, you know, I don't know.
We need a follow-up on this.
Yeah.
Okay.
But that was, Halloween next year, I have no idea what I'll be. Probably just, I don't know what I was last year.
I have some rumblings in my head of what I might be.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, yeah. We've been watching Community a lot, so I think I might go as Starburns.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's
yeah, I got the look for it, and we got a bearded dragon I can put on my shoulder. And yeah.
That's great. I'll bet this year it'll be King of... What is it? King of Thrones, or what is it?
Yeah, King of Thrones. Game of Thrones.
Game of Thrones. Yeah. Game of Thrones. I'm so out of it. The Walking Dead, of course, but how can you tell, you know?
Yeah, they're just zombies.
Zombies.
Unless you go as Rick or something, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah. Probably the Avengers. There'll probably be a lot of
Iron Man. Yeah, there's going to be tons of Avenger stuff, I'm sure.
Yeah, this gets into cosplay. I'm very interested about, you know, cosplay this year in San Diego.
Well, yeah, Comic-Con is the precursor for the Halloween costume themes. Like, you'll see what is probably going to be the resurgence this year from just what Comic-Con is.
Yeah.
Like, you get rid of all the stormtroopers and all the general ones that are always there, and those other ones that you start seeing going, oh, I hadn't seen that one before, that's probably going to be your Halloween costumes.
I'm anxious to see who's making the leap to the new Harley Quinn costume.
Oh, yeah.
Because she's had so many costumes last year. She has her traditional Bruce Timm Jester costume, which is what I see the most of. Then I see, and then quite a few have done the nurse outfit from Arkham Asylum.
Nice one. Yeah.
Then she's got a different outfit, the leather pants outfit from Arkham City. Mm-hmm. And now she's got this leather bustier bikini thing, which is more blue and purple or red and purple or red and blue from the current Suicide Squad.
Yeah.
So Harley's all over the place. It'll be interesting to see who does classic Harley and who does, you know, a variation.
Well, I just watching the Comic-Con, or not Comic-Con, but the other conventions that are going on, because it is convention season, any videos I see, I always see a Harley Quinn walking in the background.
Yeah, yeah. They're everywhere. I mean, that's become such a popular look. Zatanna also is really popular, but everybody does the showgirl Zatanna, the tuxedo and the top hat. And I've seen some that are just stunning. You know, like they're dead on, like, you know. They could be on a stage somewhere in Las Vegas.
Only once have I seen that gypsy-esque one from the Justice League, you know, Detroit era.
Oh, with the lobster on the head?
Yeah, yeah.
I saw some artwork today that had lobster head Zatanna on it from my upcoming graphic novel. That's a question. I'll get to that question in a little bit. But that, you know, the lobster head Zatanna is still pretty good. You know, that's very fondly remembered by a lot of fans. The new look where she's got... It's like the Criss Angel look where she's wearing leather pants and she's wearing the mesh on her arms and everything.
Yeah.
It's like, I don't find that as distinctive, but still, you know, it'll be interesting to see who adopts that. It's a little, I can't really tell. Is that Death or is that Zatanna? They can go either way, you know?
Yeah, it does sort
it's
of
kind of getting into the Death
the
girl. Yeah. Okay, we're ready to move on. Let's
Yeah, let's see. What's next here? I have a at Gray Matter splat.
Uh-huh.
I recently heard an episode of an old radio show that I heard Dick Beals, Dawes Butler, and DeForest Kelly. Heard any Radio Day stories?
Radio Day stories? No, I haven't lately. But this actually, I got a question a few weeks ago about old time radio and Batman. If we had any of the actors from the Golden Age of Radio who did voices on Batman and. We started recording in 92, so there were probably some veteran actors who did that crossover. I know for sure that Bob Hastings, who played our Commissioner Gordon, and fabulously so, was the voice of Archie Andrews back on the Archie series.
Oh, wow.
When Archie was on the radio, and he did a lot of voices, and he also played, I think it was Lieutenant Carpenter on McHale's Navy, second in command to Joe Flynn and on that show. That was a lot of fun. But as for those specific guys, I don't have anything other than the fact that I, you know, for years I would listen to old-time radio and I could always usually pick out Dawes's voice whenever he came on.
The next question, Happy Sorceress asks, no question, but a conversation yesterday reminded me how much I miss your Z and all the questions left unanswered, dang it.
Well, maybe I'll get around to Zatanna again someday.
Jason Anders at Commander Anders asks, what are your thoughts of the new 52 Batman comics, and have you read The Court of Owls, Night of Owls?
Yeah, I haven't read all the issues. I think they're pretty good. I think the Owls are pretty good villains for Batman. I don't know Scott Snyder. I mean, I've never actually met him face-to-face, although we've swapped emails and have chatted online a bit and everything. He seems to be doing a bang-up job, so I'm anxious to see where it goes, and I know that this week is the start of the wrap up of the Owl story.
Yeah,
and it'll be interesting to see where they go with that. But I think they're great additions to the Batman canon.
Yeah, I've been enjoying his writing, and I read a couple of his short stories not long ago, and they're really well done.
Where'd you read them?
A collection, actually, that I have of comic-based, like, super, There Are No More Superheroes, or Where Are They Now, or something uh-huh. like that. And it's just comic-themed short stories.
Is it prose?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, cool.
Yeah, it was fantastic.
Great. Awesome.
I got some from Facebook.
Yeah.
Right. Kaysen Pillioid.
Okay.
Pilliod. Sorry if I brutalized your name. What are some of the more unusual toys in your collection?
Toys in my collection? Oh, God. There's so many. Well, this is kind of tragic. I used to collect Stipe animals, and I love them because I had all my Stipes from childhood. And I got into, for the last 20 years, whenever a really unique animal came out, Stipe is a company in Germany, and they made teddy bears and classic stuffed animals. Oh, and whenever a unique animal came out, you know, because I'm kind of lukewarm about the teddy bears, but like an armadillo or a Cotamundi or a bush baby or something, Stipe would make a very limited run of them. And I had a collection of them, which included all those animals I mentioned, then okapis and dragons and everything.
Oh, wow.
And I was at my storage bin recently because I have so many toys I have to keep some of them in storage. And a rat had gotten into that one box and had destroyed them all.
No.
It had destroyed every one of them, been befouled them all. And I was able to save a couple. There were two that weren't gnawed or they weren't gnawed up badly. And there was one that was sort of bad. It was a Jungle Book Baloo the bear that my dad gave me. It was like the toy I saved since my childhood. And that got pretty badly chewed.
But anyway,
there is a place that can repair it. So I think I'm going to have it cleaned off and I'm going to find out if the Stipe repair place is in business. If anybody out there knows, you know, about the Stipe repair place, or if they can say if it's good or not, I'd be anxious to hear about it. And I'll probably get that bear replaced or, you know, restored, because I saw what this one website could do and it looked like it was pretty remarkable. They didn't quote any prices, but I guess, you know, it would be pretty outrageous. So Stipes I collected or used to collect, and things like that, you know, a lot of character based stuff.
Shane Arenal, a guy named Shane, asks, what is it like to write both Batman and Ultimate Spider-Man? What challenges come with both characters?
Oh, that's a good question. Different challenges come with each character. With Spider-Man, we've made a decision to go a lot lighter on the character to really show that at this stage in Peter's life, he's kind of Spider-Man both in and out of the costume. That he's really got this kind of hyperactive kinetic mindset that a 16-year-old would have, and his mind works a mile a minute. And it's a new take on Spider-Man, and it's a fun take on him that we haven't really seen before. We've kind of gotten away from a lot of the Sturm und Drang, which I know the fans like, but this seemed to be more in tune with, you know, a newer modern show. And so you think a lot like, okay, I'm in this kid's head. What was I like when I was a goofy 16-year-old? Okay, this is you know, my mouth is a lot faster than my head, and I blurt out before thinking and everything. And then you put that in a superhero's body. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, you know?
And it's fun working in that world, and it's fun working with the Spider-Man classic villains, and especially the kind of reworked upgrade from the Brian Bendis books over the last few years. Batman is different. It's a lot darker. It's a lot more Sturm und Drang. You're dealing with this kind of grim character who's looking for his only definition of sanity is going out at night and you know, hunting down weirdos and trying to keep the city safe, and at the same time trying to atone for the fact that he wasn't able to save his parents.
Sounds like it's like the difference between writing mystery and adventure.
Yeah, there's a lot of that, and you know, the Batman characters are weird and interesting, and they all have their own quirks and madness that drive them. And Spider-Man villains are more, I guess, more fantastic. Batman villains are more cerebral, I think. They're more imaginations and mentalities gone astray, whereas Spider-Man villains are more about mutations and people who become monsters.
Here's a question me and Emily wanted to bring up to you, actually.
Sure.
This was asked to Neil Gaiman.
Okay.
By Clamenanth. I don't know where this is from, but
okay.
She asked Mr. Gaiman, is it true that there were plans for your characters of Sandman to appear in Christmas episode of Batman the Animated Series? If it is, why didn't they appear? And he mentions that I don't think there were Christmas episode plans, just very, very vague plans. This was around 93. Paul Dini had a Sandman episode in mind, and we talked about voice casting. I think I suggested John Hurt, who was younger then.
Yeah.
I never happened. No idea why not. You'd have to ask Paul.
Well, we did talk about it, and we emailed and then we spoke in person about it. I really wanted to do it because at the time, Sandman was my favorite book. I loved it. It was everybody's favorite book. And I thought, let's do this as, you know, we're using very few DC crossover characters. It's almost impossible. It would be impossible to get Sandman in the Batman comic book, but maybe we could just be lucky and get him in the cartoon. And I really wanted to do it. The feeling was not shared by every member of my writing staff who either had never read Sandman or didn't quite get it.
Okay.
And it was not really going to be a Christmas episode per se, but it was going to be an episode. It was going to be a little like It's a Wonderful Life, where Batman had been grievously injured by somebody and was hovering between life and death. And death was actually in it, sort of in the background, kind of biding her time. And it was up to Batman whether he could go forward with her or go back. And the Sandman had shown him the good he had done and how he had inspired both dreams and nightmares in people.
Wow.
And I pitched it, and like I said, some members of the crew just didn't get it. They said, this, you know, we're kind of doing the adventure stuff, and this is, they just didn't see it. And, you know, unfortunately, it was one of those ideas that just never happened. I would like to see it, you know, dust it off and revive it. You know, maybe someday, but I'm not there anymore. So,
yeah,
you know, it's probably not going to happen.
Wow.
Well, I don't know. Maybe that's, what you can do as a one-shot comic or something.
And they are introducing the Vertigo characters more into that universe. And at least before the 52, death appeared in Superman.
Yes.
So,
Well, maybe we could do it as like an, maybe we could do it as a
untold tale,
an untold tale of a Batman adventures or something like that.
That'd be amazing.
But I'd have to bug Neil about it and say, I don't know if he would want to write it, but you know, maybe we could sort of like, I don't know, beat out a story or something like that and pitch it to DC. I don't know if they'd take it though. They probably would.
Next question I have.
Yeah.
Stingray at Stingray Travel asks, will we ever see a return of Saturday or after school cartoons? Who might be the group to do it?
Saturday cartoons?
Yeah. Or after school.
Yeah, they've been kind of hiding out for a while. They haven't been around for like the last 8 or 10 years, really. I think what happened was the networks, the big three, or big four, if you will, CBS, NBC, ABC, and now Fox have gotten out of Saturday morning because they realized the revenues just weren't... They felt like the revenues just aren't there anymore, and also... we can show other things at that time. Sports brings in bigger revenues.
And now with all the cable channels, they have sister companies that do that share the work, like Nickelodeon.
Well, that's the other thing is they feel like we don't have to program for kids anymore because there's all this cable stuff for kids.
Mm-hmm.
And that when it gets right down to the bottom line, that's really it. And it's like, why should we run cartoons? We'll just be competing with whatever Disney and Cartoon Network are doing. And they've kind of gotten out of the game and surrendered it completely to cable. And this is kind of an interesting question because it also feeds into one of the questions I get a lot of is about Tower Prep, because I know we've got some Tower Prep questions coming up, I'm sure. A lot of fans have asked me, why don't you take Tower Prep to another network? And the reason, well, it's twofold. One, Cartoon Network won't sell it. And they've basically just kind of locked the show away and are waiting, you know, for people to forget about it anyway. And the other thing is no other network wants a show for kids. They don't. And I know this because 10 years ago I was pitching Tower Prep to the networks and with the same characters, same idea, everything. And the networks had changed at that point and they'd say, you know, we're really not into programming for families or kids because there's ABC Family, there's this, there's that. We are, a lot of networks were doing reality programming and making a ton of money off reality programming, game shows, things like American Idol. And then they would have sitcoms or procedural shows. And they had, at that point, they had cut the family shows out of their block. Family shows are as dead on primetime TV as rural comedies are. At one point in the 60s and 70s, CBS was known for rural comedies like Green Acres, Beverly Hillbillies,
Little House on the Prairie.
That was on NBC, but Petticoat Junction,
Every
show's like that, American Heartland shows, even Dukes of Hazzard and everything, and Hee Haw was running around on that time. And then around 1970, somebody passed a rule at CBS and said, no more rural shows. The audience just isn't there, or we don't want them, or, we don't see that's something that we have to program for anymore. Mm. And the same thing happened with family shows. Like you used to see on, back when it was only three networks, when you were a kid, a little kid, there was things like Dukes of Hazzard, The Hulk, Wonder Woman.
Bionic Man.
Even, shows like T.J. Hooker, which mm-hmm. weren't really family shows, but they were sort of adventure shows that kids would watch.
Yeah, the A-Team.
A-Team and stuff like that. And yet those shows had an appeal. Like you could get an A-Team lunchbox, or you mm-hmm. could get action figures of the characters or something. So they would skew kind of younger. There's nothing like that anymore for kids, because the networks say they'll go over there and find it over there. So when I was pitching on cable, so when I was pitching Tower Prep, I would get like, interesting, yeah, it's good, but we're not running shows for kids anymore. Take it to a kids network. So when Cartoon Network heard the pitcher initially, they said, this is right up our alley. This is drama for kids. It's heavy duty. It's what we want. It's really engrossing. We really think it's going to have a great home here. And then Adventure Time and shows like that came on, and they said, oh, the ratings here are too good. We don't want drama anymore. Yeah. Besides, too many girls are watching. We don't want them.
Well,
so
let's see. We have Mark Hamill at Hamill himself.
Mark Hamill, oh, the man.
Yeah, he asks, you've written so many great Joker scripts. I was wondering if you have a favorite.
Any one that you've been in, Mark. Yeah, that's the short answer. True. There have been a lot
it's hard to do a Joker script without him, though.
he brought and continues to bring such great feel to the character that it's a joy to write from him. When I know that I'm writing something that Mark is going to voice, I try and challenge myself to come up with something that I haven't done before. And because I know that he is going to give it such life and such thought. And that's what I love hearing in his voice, is the thought process behind what motivates this character. As the Joker isn't just an insane guy. He isn't just a funny guy. He isn't just an incoherent guy. He's a deeply angry guy. He is mad. Not only insane, he's just anger personified and bitterness that has this veneer of clown-like innocence upon it. And you tap into what's underneath there, and it's wonderful. He's such a rich character. He's alternately childlike and then sadistic. He's angry and yet forgiving, if the mood strikes him. And then he turns on a dime and just sticks a knife in you. And Mark, plays that character like a fiddle. It's just a joy to hear him play that. And when I write the Joker, it's sort of like, okay, I got to bring my A game here. How do I write something that I haven't written before? And how do I add a new dimension to a guy who is very easily, very, very easy to screw up if I just make him, a guy who spouts bad jokes. I try and put a lot of thought into the character when I write him, and every time I hear Mark do something with the character, it's terrific. Even the end of the game when he's singing Only You, that's haunting. Some of the tapes, that we put both in Arkham City and Arkham Asylum, where he's talking or he's ranting about Batman, it's amazing.
I want to go play that game again.
Yeah. So, he is a joy to write for. We got to get him on the show.
Yeah.
Yeah. We got to yank him over here sometime. Yeah. Or we'll go over to him. Or we'll meet someplace in between.
I can travel.
When we first started doing things, like podcasts, we did a little film thing on our camera that was so crummy looking of him and Rashi. And it was like, he was such a good sport about it. But I really would like to have a nice sit down with him where I, do a nice interview with him and we talk. So,
yeah, I only got to speak to him once, just casually at a comic book store I frequent, and he was just such a great guy, just so open, and talked about his kids, and
There's a lot of talent in that family. Yeah. The kids are very, very talented, and And yeah, it's wonderful. Every chance I have to work with him is a joy.
I imagine. Well, the next question.
Yes.
From Speaker or Pandrew.
Speaker, how are you?
At Speaker Wiggin.
Yes.
How about your 2012-13 con schedule?
Not going any.
None at all? Not even going to swing down to Comic-Con?
I got to do Comic-Con.
Okay. But not in any others.
Well, a lot of people ask me, but the simple reality of it is I work all the time.
Yeah.
And it's not that I don't enjoy going out and meeting fans and going to a show or something. It's just that in the last few years especially, things have just sort of, you know, been kicked up a notch for me. I have a lot of, you know, responsibilities to the shows I'm working on, and I work hard and I play hard. And so when it's playtime, mm-hmm. Missy and I usually go off someplace, or we spend the weekend with the dogs or something, and I really have to budget my comic convention time wisely. And I feel like at one point, you know, when I was single and I had nothing to do on the weekends, and yeah. When I worked at Warner's, and it would be like, there's an opportunity for somebody to go speak at Chicago, who wants to go? It would be like, you know, at the time Bruce Timm was married and he still is, and had his first child, and it would be like, well, you know, I'm staying at home with my wife and daughter, why don't you go? And it's like, well, I got nothing happening this week, I'll go. So I would jump on a plane and I'd go off and shake hands and do the talk and run some footage and everything. I did that a lot, and it was a lot of fun. Although toward the end of when I was doing it around 2000 or so, it got kind of, I didn't enjoy it as much. It was sort of like, I began to feel how comedians feel when they go off and they do play small clubs, and they go out and they chat in front of the crowd. They get the crowd worked up and they all come and see the stuff and everything. It's really great. And then I would hear from comics, they'd just go home and watch CNN for 10 hours and try and not think about, you know, life beyond that. And yeah. then before they had to go out and do it again. And I began to feel like it got very lonely for me, you know, because I was going out and doing this kind of song and dance and promoting the show or whatever comics I was working on. And then at the end, you know, if quite often there'd be other pros at the show, some of whom I only knew by reputation or I'd met maybe once or twice, but nobody I was really, you know, knock around buddies with. You know, it'd be a lot of really nice folks, but nobody I would feel comfortable with, like banging on the door and saying, let's go split a pizza or something.
Yeah.
So I just eat room service and kind of feel kind of like, I kind of don't want to do this anymore as much as I like it. You know, when I've got a new book coming out or a game release or something like that, when it makes sense to go out and promote it, I will.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and because then I think that's where it becomes more of a special occasion. But I'm not a guy who goes off every weekend and goes to Comic-Cons. San Diego is the one exception because it is sort of like a big party.
And it's in your backyard.
It's in a backyard. You know, you go down, you run down for a day or so, and I feel good. I can go down for 3 days or I can go down for one day.
And like you said, everybody goes down there.
Everybody
so
goes
it's
down
not
there.
Only, you know, a chance to go to the Duke cons, but you can actually talk to people that you've been meaning to talk to and have a meeting or something like that.
Right. And this year I did it smart. I called up a bunch of friends and, you know, it's now a month out. And I said, hey, you know, you want to grab dinner this night or this night? So I've already made reservations,
that's
you know,
fantastic.
For the times I'm going to be there. So, you know, I'm going to be doing some work while I'm there, some just socializing. And so, you know, the time's all booked up. That's great.
Sounds good.
Yeah, that's the one, though. I have plans to be on a couple of panels. And I don't know exactly when the panels are going to be, but I'll probably announce those in the next couple of weeks once I find out.
Brendan Fields at Hamel Price is asking, would you ever write a script for an animated adaptation of The Killing Joke?
No, and I'll tell you why. I think it's a great book, and I don't think it would make a very good movie, quite honestly. I think that there's something about the ending that really works as a moment between Batman and the Joker. And there's something about it that I think if you adapted it as written and did it animated, I think it would actually piss off a lot of the audience, especially a younger audience that doesn't see the shading between the two characters and the similarity. And I don't think it would be the greatest story to tell in animation. You know, that story ends on this brilliant understanding between the two characters. Mm-hmm. It's almost like a truce happens when the tension is broken and they laugh. And then Batman takes the Joker and hands him over to the police. But everything prior to that, the horrific abuse Barbara suffers,
yeah.
and the humiliation Gordon is subjected to, there's no resolution to that. You don't. It's not a happy story,
Have them laugh and shrug it off at the end. You saying that, I totally agree. I was thinking about recently that there's something wrong. Well, not wrong with the ending, but there's something about the ending that just doesn't feel complete.
Yeah.
Or doesn't. Yeah, it doesn't bring it back.
I mean, as I remember reading it when I was a lot younger, and it pissed me off. I got to the end. I'm going, wait a minute. Gordon is still there, naked. Joker has killed all these people. Barbara Gordon is crippled, perhaps permanently. And Batman's just laughing with them over this sort of cerebral joke that is not really all that funny. It's sort of like they arrive at the same point of view, and there's this moment of truce, understanding between them, but that's it. I mean, all the great setup, I'm really braced for the ultimate Batman-Joker, finale, however it comes down here. And it takes you to a different place. And I'm not saying that's bad. And on subsequent rereading of the story, because I'm sitting down and I'm like, kid, I want to see Batman really beat the shit out of the Joker for this. And he doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't end the way that you expected. But then you read it and you realize it's a very rich, very textured, very sad story about these two guys who are not all that far away from each other. But I don't think it would translate that well into animation. It would just be a downer. And I think that people who expect something a little different. I mean, when you watch an animated cartoon, it does a lot of magic on you in a way you're not really conscious of. You become really invested in the story in a way that you aren't quite invested when you're just reading it. And there are all these elements, the voices, the music especially, it brings you into this world. And to change the ending of the story would not be doing justice to what made the story great. You'd be grafting on a big action moment, perhaps, or the Joker finally getting his comeuppance from Batman, and then you'd go, like, that didn't happen in the book. And then to let it play off the way it does in the book is sort of like, well, it was great up until last minute, then it all fell flat. I mean, I wouldn't want the responsibility of translating it. I can't say that it absolutely couldn't be made into a film. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying that me personally, given the choice between that and writing something original, I'd say, let me write an original story. If you want Batman and the Joker, let me write something original with these characters and let me make it something from my heart and my imagination and my take on these characters rather than try and just move around what Alan Moore was trying to do. And I think that's always the way to go, but then, The Killing Joke sold a lot of books and, you're buying a brand at that point. So that's my long-winded answer.
Next question. I'm going to pair up a couple of them.
Okay.
Somebody mentioned that they found the pilot script of Tower Prep floating around on the internet, and if there were any others around.
Oh, I saw that. Yeah, that was an early draft of the script, and no, I haven't seen any others around.
And then would you ever consider posting some of your unused scripts or concepts on your website?
No.
Okay, fair enough. Mm-hmm. If they want to see your script, they can always buy Return of the Joker.
There's that, and I also feel like an unproduced script of mine, why should I? It's like, it wasn't made. It didn't, it was some, maybe it was
Oh,
something.
Yeah, you're right, unused, sorry, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's like, I broke the rule once, I wrote a Batman team-up as a direct-to-video, and parts of it were incorporated into some of the Brave and Bold episodes. Mm-hmm. And it was going to be a Batman's Greatest Team-Ups, and it was narrated by Alfred, and it was a Batman-Superman team-up, a Batman-Green Arrow team-up, a Batman-Zatanna team-up, and a Batman-Plastic Man team-up.
Oh, nice.
And bits and pieces of those were sort of cannibalized into other stories.
Mm-hmm.
And the Batman Superman team up was kind of the longest, and yet in a weird way it was the one that didn't fit. And it was Batman Superman versus Mr. Mixes Piddalick and Batmite. So it was fun and it was goofy and it was over the top, and it was like World's Funnest, the book that Evan Dorkin had written. It wasn't based on that,
yeah.
But it had that similar tone. It was more like the 50s, Batman Superman versus their respective sprite enemies. And so we were never going to do it. And then what happened was recently, about 2 years ago, Brad Meltzer had an auction going to preserve, I believe it was Joe Shuster's house. And it was online, and various people were donating Superman memorabilia for an auction to save it. And I remember I kind of took that script, cut it out of that section of the script, the Superman, Batman, cut it out of the script and kind of, you know, repackaged it and offered that for sale for auction,
yeah,
as like the unproduced episode of Batman, the animated series, or Superman, an unproduced Superman, Batman adventure. And somebody bought it. And, but that was like, this was something that was going to be produced. We decided not to. And then I thought, well, it's for a good cause. I'll put it out there.
That's fair enough. Yeah, I mean, the only reason I ever like looking at other writers' scripts is just to see how they format things and see how they, you know, go about structure and stuff, just because I'm still young and new at it, and I just like other views of that and see if, oh, is there something about this that I can adapt into my work?
Well, at some point, I think I will put out some more of my scripts or publish them. One of the things I would really like to do, it's probably too late for this year, but maybe for next Christmas, I would love to do a hardbound Jingle Bell collection. Well, like take the best of Jingle Bell stories and then, you know, make it kind of like a director's edition and
perfect
put a lot of
that stuff.
The original sketches of Jing over the years by myself and various other artists who've worked on the book. And then one of the scripts and, you know, the models and everything, and put that out there, and then do the stories in color. You know, some of the black and white stories that haven't been colored yet.
I could see a hardcover looking like a gift wrap package right now.
Well, I would love that, and put it out in the humor book section. And unfortunately, you know, you kind of have this disadvantage. You know, the character is so cute that a lot of parents have said to me, "Oh, it looks kind of sexy for Christmas." So it would have to be in the humor book section, not the section that has, you know, like the little children's Santa Claus fairy tales. Also, you know, finding a publisher for it is would be kind of a trick. So there are not a lot of people out there who are publishing humor books these days. I might have to go indie publishing on that.
Ben Carver at Ben Comic Graphics asks, what's your best Lou Scheimer story?
Best Lou Scheimer story. Lou Scheimer was one of the executive producers and creators of the Filmation Studio, along with Norm Prescott. They were partners for years in the 60s and 70s through the, I guess, the early 90s, producing animation. And he was my first boss. He and Norm, they were the first producers I ever worked for back in around 1980. Lou was a great guy. He really worked very hard to keep American production going in the United States in the face of rising costs a lot of the studios had been outsourcing animation overseas and everything, and he really tried to keep as much in-house as he could. I don't know if I really have any specific stories about him, other than he was just this big gregarious guy and you know, fun to talk to and everything, and he gave me a wonderful opportunity. A lot of people worked for Lou, their first jobs. Tom Ruger worked there. He and I worked together very early on, around 1980. Bruce Timm worked there, John Crisfalusi, Tom Minton. Everybody had either their first job or last job in animation working at Filmation. They were hiring guys who were like around 21 years old, if not younger. And then there were a bunch of older animators who had been either retired or semi-retired who would come in and do animation work. So it was fascinating talking to some of the guys who had been working in the golden age of animation who were still working and doing work at Filmation. Yeah, just I just like Lou an awful lot. He's a great guy.
Vivian Chavot from at Black Pearl Lady asks, what project has been the most challenging one so far?
My most challenging projects are the ones that I write for myself, because those are the ones that don't have any particular deadline to them, and yet if I don't finish them, nobody else will. So those become these kind of demons in my imagination demanding to be finished and pressing upon me how important time is to devote to my own stories and to get them out there. So I've got a couple of things that I'm trying to get out there. There's a novel I'm working on, children's novel and a screenplay and some other things. And those are the ones that are hardest. Those are the ones that are hardest to finish. And, you know, the secret to writing isn't really writing and revising. It's just finishing. As soon as you've got a finished draft of something, you've got something to work from. So trying to finish my own personal projects are the ones that are most challenging. And yet, you know, somehow I get around to them. Jingle Bell was a personal project. Mutant Texas was a personal project. Those characters just existed in my head so vividly that I had to get them out and on paper. And so I've got a few that I'm working on right now.
Yeah, I can't wait to see them. Mm-hmm. J3H is asking, you stated earlier that you retired your Batman cowl. Does that include future installments of Arkham games?
I'm not talking about the Arkham games because I don't know about the Arkham games at the moment. So I'm not working on the comic books right now. And so you never say never.
Oh, yeah.
Actually, there's something I'm not ready to talk about, but it looks like it's going to happen, which I've got one really big Batman story in me, kind of a strange and surprising one, and it looks like I may be telling that story very soon. But that's as to how I'm going to tell it and what medium it's going to be in, I'll just leave that a secret for now. It's not a movie, I'll tell you that much. It's not okay. It's not the next movie after the Christian Bale movies.
Let's see. Zach Kastner mm-hmm. wants to know what your views on Hush, Tom Elliott character. Do you find a standout quality? He really enjoyed your take on him.
Oh, that's great. Hush is a really terrific character. I had a lot of fun with him. Jeff Loeb came up with this great character, this very bitter, resentful character who had been in Bruce Wayne's shadow. And what I tried to do was play on that idea, you know, of somebody who is the darker mirror image, not necessarily of Batman, but of Bruce Wayne. And the more I dealt with him that way, the more I thought about him that way, the more vivid a character he became for me, because it's almost like Batman is like secondary to Hush's thinking. It's like, you're Bruce Wayne. You're the guy I could, in my parents' eyes, I could never measure up to being. You're wealthy. Your parents are dead, which I take as a blessing in my own case. Everybody loves you, and you're known throughout the world. You're phenomenally wealthy. Oh, and you get to be Batman? I couldn't hate you more. And so that idea of resentment, of hating somebody so much they want to become that person, is really what I found fascinating about Hush. It's got some echoes of Two-Face to it, you know, you know, the whole idea of the face, the disfigured face and everything, and how you look back at yourself in the mirror and what that distorted image is. But I tried to take it to a different place. And I had a lot of fun. And I really liked the sequence where that we did in the Detective in the Streets of Gotham, where Tommy Elliot was locked up by Robin and Nightwing. And it's like, if you're going to look like Bruce Wayne, you made yourself look like Bruce Wayne. Okay, you're going to stand in for Bruce Wayne so the world won't know that he's dead
or he's gone.
And I got to do things like... I had fun with him. So it's like, if I'm going to look like Bruce Wayne, I'm going to spend Bruce Wayne's money. And so every chance he could, he'd go off and buy something stupid, or he'd like donate millions of dollars, and they couldn't really stop him because he was doing something for a good cause, but only he knew that the money was actually sort of...
That was really fun having, because Bruce Wayne was not around in the comic line for
about a year.
After the Grant Morrison thing.
Yeah.
And it was just really nice having this character who's like, yeah, I know I look like Bruce Wayne. I'm going to sort of smudge his name, but it's still benefiting Bruce Wayne because he's visible. And it was just fascinating watching that.
I would do little things like he opened up a gag factory, and it was the same gag factory or card factory that the Joker had been disfigured in. And, you know, under the guise of bringing back local business, but no, there's no factory in the United States that currently makes toys or cards or anything like that. It's all made overseas. And to make it here, it's horrifically expensive to open a factory and staff it with union people and distribute it. That's why nothing like that exists anymore. And yet, as you know, Tommy Elliott knew exactly the money, that there'd be no return on this investment. Mm-hmm. And this is not blowing up the city, and it's not a dark, evil plot, and no one's going to die as a result of it. But it's just a nasty thing to do that is going to cause them costs him millions, and yet he's going to come out looking good for it. And, you know, it's a small, it's almost too real a world thing to belong in Batman's world. But I enjoyed doing stuff like that. I enjoyed when they had other members of the Justice League kind of babysitting him, like Katana or the Creeper or Zatanna or something. At one point, he goes to a premiere and Zatanna is sort of assigned to babysit him for the night. So to the world, it looks like Bruce Wayne and Zatanna are out on a date. And Tommy says something to the press like, are you involved? No, you know, you can't imagine how I feel about this woman. I give up everything for her and, you know, blah, 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 blah. Which is kind of what Zatanna always wanted Bruce to say to her, you know. And so she's hearing kind of like a mocking version of it played back to him. And her attitude is just like, just get through the evening and put this creep back in his cage. But he knows that it's pissing her off. And to me, that's the joy of that character. He's just, he knows how to work people.
Very much a, more of a psychological or like, you know, I'm going to get under your skin sort of person instead of an all-out bad guy.
Yeah, and I would write scenes like that, and I'd go like, this isn't action. This is like procedural stuff. I should be writing CSI or something. Why am I boring audiences by putting in, you know, all this character stuff? I should just have shit blow up. But anyway, they amused me.
Very nice. Jeffrey Brown was asking, how was it like to work with Bruce Timm on Batman the Animated Series and comics like Mad Love?
Uh-huh.
And then given the opportunity to do another Jingle Bell Madame Mirage crossover, would you have Bruce be the artist?
Let's see. Oh, do you have some artwork by him?
Yeah, he also asked what you thought of their pinups that they had on Facebook, and here they are.
Oh,
wow. Just did this as a honor of your wonderful podcast.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Oh, that's really funny.
They're big fans.
Oh, there's Rashy. Man, what a demon. Misty looks great. And there I am wearing my my bowling shirt and about to be fed to a very hungry-looking dolphin or shark or something. Probably one of our creatures that we've got. That's awesome. That's really great. Thank you. It's another Jingle Bell. Well, they never have teamed up, so I can't do another team up.
But, oh yeah, well that's worded.
I guess he meant like another Jingle Bell or Madame Mirage book or something. You know, I would love to have Bruce draw anything. I would love to work with him again on anything, but his schedule is way too full to do that. I think if we were going to collaborate on anything, we might do a Batman thing for old time's sake, but. Even now, we're just, I know our lives are way too chaotic and way too swamped. We tried seeing a movie together last week. You know, it's like I had an extra ticket for this Frankenstein movie that Misty and I were going to go see. It was actually amazing. It was Benedict Cumberbatch playing Victor Frankenstein and Johnny Lee Miller playing the monster. And we wound up with a couple of extra tickets. And you know, Bruce is a huge Frankenstein buff. So I said, hey, you want to go to the movies? And, you know, if you want to bring... Marta and Sam, you know, we're more than welcome. And we were really trying to make it work. And it just at the last minute, you know, it was just like, we can't do it. We're sorry. So
I heard good things about that.
I'm down to seeing Bruce maybe once a year at Comic-Con. I'll go by his table and it'll be about seven people deep, all asking for Catwoman and Batgirl sketches. And it'll be like, hey. And then that's it for the year.
Yeah. In fact, that's where I first hooked up with you for this podcast.
That's right. That's right.
Right in front of his table. So that was nice. I'm not sure I understand this, but Thomas Dorsey at the Arrow Dragon asks, hey, Paul, any news on Bloodspell? When?
Oh, Bloodspell. Yeah, that's the Zatanna graphic novel, the Black Canary Zatanna graphic novel.
Oh, I didn't realize that's the name of it.
I just saw a huge chunk of pages from it today.
I've been seeing Joe Quinones put some stuff on Instagram every once in a while, like the Plastic Man with the little Zatanna.
The Justice League shot? Yeah.
My goodness.
I gotta say, there's a lot. What's great about this is that Joe has hit on Black Canary and Zatanna from every phase of their of their history together. And I don't want to spoil too much, but if you ever had a favorite look for either of these characters, it's in the book.
Wow.
Because there's a big overarching story that the characters are involved in, but it's really a history of how they know each other and how they became friends. Because maybe it only exists in my head and the heads of maybe seven or eight fans. I always think of those characters as really good friends. They may not see a lot of each other, but out of everybody else in the league, the classic Justice League, Black Canary and Zatanna probably are the two most likely to hang out together, to be best friends, to, you know, support each other when the other one has a problem. They both love Wonder Woman. Wonder Woman's great. Yeah. Taking nothing away from her. Batgirl's fine. But, and the reason for that is, again, this is predicated by nothing except it was a scene I wanted to write. There is a scene, I think it's actually the first scene in the book, shows their very first meeting. And it is something that has never been hinted at in comics before. It takes place far, far, far in their past. And yet it's a very cool moment. And so I hope, you know, people read that. And even though it has never existed before in the world of these characters, I hope people read that and they go, oh yeah, I could buy that. I could believe that was the first time these two characters ever saw each other. And it's, as this longer overarching story progresses, there are these flashbacks to other moments that take place throughout DC history, you know, and in the reality, you know, we're talking, these women are pretty young. It would probably be just like 2 or 3 years, but in that time, it covers like 2 or 3 decades in those, wow, those flashbacks. It's a lot of fun. There's a lot of humor in it. I saw this great page where I get turned into a fish. I'm not going to say anything more about it than that. I don't usually write myself into stuff, but Joe had this inspiration, so he can watch for that scene. Anyway.
Yeah, Joe is a fantastic artist. Let's see. Next question is Tamor Dar at TD Spidey.
Tamor Dar, isn't he a Green Lantern? Or is he one of like a orange or yellow or chartreuse lantern at this point?
He asks, or she, can't wait for the Hulk and Agents of Smash. Any particular favorite Hulk storyline and or writers?
Getting back to Green Lantern for a second, I want to see the plaid lanterns. They're all Scotsmen and all they do is conjure up booze and they drink it.
I like that idea.
I know you would like that.
They don't have a ring. They just have the bagpipe.
Yeah. Favorite Hulk story. I love the Hulk. I mean, he's a terrific character. It was one of, when I was a kid, the Hulk was on my monthly pull list when I at the comic book store.
Oh, wow.
Once I realized what a pull list was and I realized that the bored, disinterested, and rather portly gentleman on the stool behind the counter would actually save comics for me, I said, could you put a Hulk and a Conan for me aside every month? And his dad was like, yeah, I'll do that. And so I would read it every month. And I loved Hulk at that point. You know, Herb Trimpe was drawing it, mm-hmm, and everything. So I can't pick out a favorite Hulk story, even, but that was kind of like my favorite version of the Hulk. What can I say about Agents of Smash? Nothing. Yeah. Other than the fact that I love it. I'm working with really terrific writers. We have a great time in the room. I can say that today we were breaking some stories in the room with all the writers together, and we were just having a terrific time. And if I say anything more, Jeff Loeb's going to run in the door and spank me, so I'm not going to say any more.
Then let's stop right there.
Yes.
Mark Bryant at Mark A. Bryant says, you made them all my favorite. Loved you on Kevin Smith podcast as well.
Oh, that was great. Oh, thank you. I love doing that podcast with Kevin, and I get like an email from him a week saying, dude, you crushed it. You totally killed on that. And it's like, that's great. You know, and a lot of people have sent me messages saying, when are you going back on there? And it's like, he's only done one. I can't be a guest again right away.
Yeah.
I don't want to do it, because then it's fat men on Batman, you know, and it screws it up. But it's, I want to hear other guests on there. I want to hear Christian Bale on there. I want to hear Scott Snyder. I want to hear Grant Morrison. I want to hear Adam West. There are so many people out there that you can get. Then I know Kevin's doing like, what, 7 podcasts a day? So I don't think he's done another Batman one, but I'm as anxious as anybody to hear them again. And then, you know, down the road, you know, next year or so, you know, if he wants me again, I'd be happy to do it again. I think it would be great.
Let's see. Robert Luke mentions, not to butt in and not kissing ass here, but Mad Love is my fan favorite.
Oh, cool. Love that one too.
Somebody also mentions, the one you mentioned to Mark on, Twitter, Joker's Favor. They asked, wasn't that the one with first Harley Quinn episode too?
Yeah. Joker's Favor was the first Joker story I'd ever written. And, that also introduced Harley Quinn because I wanted there to be a kind of, wise ass girl henchman who would get some funny lines in, and Joker wouldn't be happy about that. She just made, you know, there's no reason for henchmen to just sit there and be dull. You know, he had two guys sitting there who were kind of, you know, big loxy henchmen that I named after two of the of Bilko's henchmen on the Sergeant Bilko show. I called them Rocco and Henshaw.
I didn't even realize that. That's great.
Well, I remember when we did the episode, Bobby Costanzo, who played Bullock, is in the recording studio and he's going like, Rocco and Henshaw from the Bilko show. And I go, absolutely. Because, you know, as a kid, I never watched Bilko in its first run, but they used to rerun it when I was a kid, like 11:30 at night. And I would watch these shows and they're just hysterical. And I thought, and I love the fact that he had these two goofballs working for them. So I was thinking, what's a good name for henchmen? You know, you could always call them Biff and Pow, or, you know, Giggle and Gaggle or something. And then I thought, Rocco and Henshaw, no one's going to get it but me. And Phil Silvers is dead. He's not in any shape to get it. But, you know, a few people did. A few diehards did. So that was fun. I love Joker's favor because Mark hit the ball out of the park on everything the Joker had to do in there. He had to be kind of like a pal to the guy he's terrorizing. He had to be scary. He had to be threatening. He had to be vicious. And at the end, he turns on it. When the guy turns on him, the Joker is legitimately scared, you know. And the Joker's big fear is like, Batman's not going to come in time, and some, you know, little idiot twerp is going to leave me dying here. You know, that's like his worst nightmare, at least in that episode. And so I like it when the Joker can be scared. I don't think he's crazy and he's nuts and everything, but there are moments, there are little windows where he is a sane person and can be hurt in the way a sane person can. And every time Mark finds that sweet spot in the Joker's voice, it's amazing. That's what makes me want to write toward that. That's great. Again, Mark, when you come in here, we can discuss this at length.
Yeah. Let's see. Ian Strope at Ian Strope asks, what was the experience working with Morrison during the RIP Heart of Hush runs? Those were super good.
Oh, good. I'm glad you liked those. It was just sort of, you know, Grant was taking the lead on that, on the story with the death of Batman and everything. So I'm not sure how it was for the other writers, but it was sort of like, these are the parameters Grant is working in. Here's where your story is taking place. Kind of let's see how these two can dovetail. So it was challenging, but it was also a lot of fun.
Seriously, on behalf of all of us, San Bernard says, young and old, the Batman animated series to Arkham City. Thank you both. Love the fans.
Well, thank you, fans.
And people just love seeing you two talk on Twitter.
That's great. Yeah, I'm thrilled people, you know, love the animated series. I guess it's still running somewhere or in reruns and people can see it and everything. Yeah. And, you know, it was so great writing for Mark. What people can't forget is that we had tremendous artists and directors and storyboard people who were challenged to do their very best. And, you know, Bruce Timm was such a huge part of this. And I remember, you know, he's like, it's really a triumvirate. It's me writing, Bruce storyboarding or directing or, you know, plotting out visually, and then Mark's voice. And I remember when we did this one episode, which I think is one of Mark's big favorites. We did this episode called The Man Who Killed Batman, where Batman's death is not blamed on the Joker. It's blamed on a real third-rate little, you know, Weasley Gunsel who somehow gets the upper hand and seemingly kills Batman. But when the Joker gets news of it, he mourns Batman. He pulls a funeral for him, and then he caps it off by murdering the guy who killed Batman, or trying to. And when I wrote that script, I wrote, you know, what I thought the Joker would say in memory of Batman, you know, because they have a great rapport, or not rapport, but history together. It's legendary. And if Joker was called to speak at Batman's funeral, he'd say things that, you know, he'd be all over the place. I hated him. I loved him. I, you know, matched wits with him. He was a great challenge. You know, I hope he goes to hell. You know, he'd be all over the place. So I tried to write, you know, something really fun for Mark to say. And Mark loved it. And he did a phenomenal job on it. And I remember Bruce did all the posing on that sequence. Oh. And he did all the storyboarding and all the emotion in the Joker's face. You know, he's happy, he's sad, a little tear runs down his eye, he's funny. If you ever have the chance to see that storyboard, that section of the storyboard, it's some of Bruce's best stuff. It's absolutely inspired, and there are moments in it that are just, while the Joker is, you know, eulogizing Batman, are really funny, because at one point you see this henchman, Sid the Squid, the guy who supposedly killed Batman, standing with the Joker's henchmen, you know, with Harley and the others. And when the Joker starts to single him out as the guy who killed Batman, all the other henchmen just kind of move off to the side and lead Sid there by himself, because he knows this is not going to be good. And at the end, the Joker, because they don't have a body to bury, they take Sid and they throw him in a vat of acid. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of fun. And then the Joker's mood brightens and he's like, well, that was fun. Let's get some Chinese. And then off they go. Bruce caught every moment of that. It's just, you know, it's there in Mark's voice and it's there in the posing. And when it's all there like that, it's just terrific. And, anymore? Are we ready to wrap it up this time?
Ready to wrap it up, except one last thing from Mark Hamill. He did tweet one last mention to just the fans. For those who are wondering, it's too hard to pick just one Joker script. There's value in them all.
Yes, I agree. They were all fun, and Mark made them so.
Wow, that was a good one.
That's good. Yeah, it's fun answering questions like that. It's takes me down memory lane on, you know, toward Batland and everything. Sorry, Misty couldn't make it, but hopefully we'll have her again next week.
Yeah, and if anybody else has any questions that we couldn't get to, please feel free to leave them on our Facebook, or send them to Radio Rashi, at Radio Rashi on Twitter, and we'll gather them up for the next time.
See you next time. Same bat time, same bat channel. Or has that been said before?
I think it's said often, but it's still fun.
Yep.
This has been another episode of Radio Rashi. If you've enjoyed this episode, let everyone know by leaving a review in the iTunes Store. It's a great way to help others find us. You can also leave comments on RadioRashi.com, Facebook.com/RadioRashi, or follow us on Twitter at Radio Rashi or at Paul_Dini to leave us questions. Thanks for listening, and tell your friends.